Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
I'm Arthur Snell. A major war is taking place on the European continent with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, bringing you a series of special episodes to help you understand the crisis as it unfolds. This is Doomsday Watch. Welcome back to another Doomsday Watch War Bulletin. We want to start off by saying thank you for tuning in. Listeners like you are the bedrock of our work. If you're finding these war bulletins useful, you can support us by backing us on the crowdfunding app Patreon. You'll get the shows early, ad-free, help us shape future episodes, and get exclusive merchandise, all from just £3 a month. Just search Patreon Doomsday Watch or follow the links in the show notes. I'm joined today by Dr. Mike Martin, a familiar voice to many of the listeners, and he's going to talk to us about Ukraine's stunning advance in the east of that country. Mike, welcome.
Hello, Arthur.
Mike, let's get straight into it. Really dramatic things are happening on Ukraine's eastern front. I think the latest is it 7,000 square?
I saw nine. I mean, it's hard, you know.
Yeah.
It's a lot, isn't it?
That's a lot of land. What's your sort of an initial take on what's going on there?
Basically, the Ukrainians are really good at misdirecting the Russians. So they sent them down south to, they were having this big offensive in Kherson. The Russians deployed loads of troops down there because Kherson's really important. It's on the route to Crimea. Crimea is the strategic center of gravity for the Russians. And to reinforce Kherson, the Russians have to thin out troops from everywhere else, including this front line to the east of Kharkiv. And the Ukrainians spotted an opportunity and just punched through with armor and then just followed it up with really fast mechanized forces that in a lot of cases bypassed the Russian combat troops and just went straight for their logistics and their command and control and all that jazz. And that just caused the Russians to collapse. They surrendered. The Ukrainians took Kupiansk, which is a major rail junction. And then the Russians surrendered Izyum because that was supplied from Kupiansk, so on and so forth. And they've just continually encircled these pockets of Russians who've just given up and run away or put on civilian clothes.
So one of the units to be taken over is the Russian First Guards Tank Army,
which is
supposed to be like an elite force. That's a serious sort of humiliation for the Russians.
Well, I mean, look, so the word elite is bandied about so much when it comes to military stuff. It's a serious, I guess, what could I liken it to? It's a bit like the Desert Rats, you know, the 7th Armored Brigade in the British sort of order of battle. It's a unit that's done some stuff and has got a bit of a history. Is it elite? I mean, you know, people get posted in and out of these units all the time. It was the one I read somewhere that was on the NATO order of battle for the defense of Moscow.
Yeah.
It is no more. It has been removed as a functioning organization from the battlefield, which is quite something to, you know, any whether it's elite or not, to remove any formation from a battlefield is extraordinary.
Yeah. The Russians don't seem to be trying to resupply and sort of defend these areas. They've as you say, they've basically given up. What does that tell us about their own sort of prosecution of this war?
Yeah, so their command structure is pretty top down and sclerotic. And so it's hard to get decisions made. And if you've got fast mechanized forces kind of cutting off your supply lines, then you need to make quick decisions, and they haven't, which has meant that the whole thing just collapsed. What they tried to do was about 60 or 70 miles east of Kharkiv, there's a river called the River Oskil. So they tried to reform a defensive line on that river. So just to the south of this area that we're talking about is the two places, Severodonetsk and Lysychansk, which, you know, your listeners will probably remember from the Battle of the Donbass over the summer. And there are sort of Ukrainian attacks going on there as well. So the question is whether these, but previously the Donbass and the northeastern bit were seen as two separate sectors of the war, but because they were largely supplied by the same logistics network that now the Ukrainians have collapsed, it seems probably like these two bits of the war are going to coalesce into what, you know, the Russians need to stabilize one front there, basically. Yeah. And that's what they're trying desperately to do at the moment.
Yeah. And looking at this, as you mentioned, Severodonetsk, Lysychansk, these were areas that the Russians were able to take earlier in the year. Mm. And their methodology is very different. Of course, it's sort of pounding these populated areas with artillery. Mm. When we look at this different way of doing war, the Ukrainians making this rapid advance or the Russian methodology of sort of rubbleizing.
It's maneuver versus attrition, right?
Yeah. Is that because the Russians don't have the kind of relevant skills and command structure to do maneuver? Or is there some other reason that the Russians seem to have gone very slowly and then had this rapid setback?
It's a bunch of things. So, command structure, they're very hierarchical. Armies tend to mirror their cultures, right? So in a country where the power distance is great, like Russia, then you tend to end, or North Korea or whatever, you tend to end up with sort of very hierarchical armies where person at the top has to sign off what the person at the bottom is having for breakfast.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. The second thing is Russia's army is conscript army. Right. And if you come into, and warfare is quite complicated in 2022. Mm. So if you come into that army, you're only going to be in for a year and you're not paid anything and you don't really want to be in the army anyway, you know, you're not going to be a highly skilled nor motivated recruit.
Yeah.
So that means really that actually attritional warfare, where you just sling loads of artillery shells downrange and then try and, you know, think of it, the First World War, and then try and do kind of infantry waves. That's what you can, that's all you're left with, because that's sort of low skill warfare. Mm. Contrast that with most Western armies and the Ukrainians who operate, they try and do maneuver warfare, which is about what we, it's kind of what we described, you know, unsettling your enemy, unbalancing them, psychologically attacking them by cutting off their command and control, their logistics, all that kind of stuff, to basically shatter their morale, cohesion, will to fight. That requires a kind of decentralized command structure where the British version of it is called mission command, where what you do is you give the task to someone. I want you to defeat this enemy formation, but you don't tell them how to do it. It's up to them how they want to do it. And if you think about that, armies are segmented. If that works all the way down from the strategic level down to the section commander, that means that people feel empowered. They've got initiative and they can think and make decisions. They feel able to make decisions because they know overall what they're trying to achieve, but it's up to them how they achieve their little bit of that. That requires a much more highly educated and trained army and a kind of different philosophy or a different culture within the military. So it's very hard to move from one style of army to the other, but an attritional army is always going to get disjointed and routed by a maneuver army of comparable sizes. And really in Ukraine, the armies are of comparable sizes. You know, the maneuver army just thinks much faster. It gets inside the decision-making loop of the attritional army.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Looking at what Ukraine has achieved so far, it's an area of territory bigger than Wales, which is one of those sort of units of measurements that people like to use.
How many football pitches is it?
Yeah, well, yeah, that's it. I haven't figured that one out yet. I'll come back to you on that. It's one Wales, but it's lots of rugby pitches. Yeah, but I suppose the big question might be, is it sustainable? Because, of course, those of us outside observers willing them onwards, you see that south of where they've got to is the sort of core area of the Donbass, which of course the Russians have occupied in one way or another since 2014. Do you think that they've got the momentum to carry on in that direction, or is there going to be a sort of inevitable kind of pause and regroup?
So there's always a pause and a regroup. You need to let your logistics catch up, and you need to cycle your troops, right? Because it's exhausting, that kind of warfare, because you're on the go constantly. So you need to kind of rotate companies in and out. So I'm assuming that the Ukrainians have built their army in such a fashion that they're able to do that. I think the bigger question is, do they have a strategic reserve? Because, you know, if the Russians stabilize their front line, then that, even if the Ukrainians are rotating companies in and out and they've got logistics, that's going to kind of slow down and, you know, settle into some front lines before, you know. But if the Ukrainians have a strategic reserve, then that means they'll just start off in another direction.
Yeah.
And actually, you spoke about, you know, are they going to go into Donbass? I mean, if I were the Ukraine army, I wouldn't go anywhere near Donbass. The place, you know, ultimately, the bit that Russia really cares about is Crimea. Mm. And if warfare is psychological and it's about striking fear into the hearts of your enemy, you want them to feel unsafe in Crimea. And so that, to me, well, they could carry on the Kherson front, or that's quite usefully tying up loads of Russian troops. They could, if they've got a strategic reserve, I would just punch down from the kind of from Dnipro or Zaporizhia right down to the Black Sea coast. Your listeners will recall that the Russians have got people in the east in the Donbass, they've got Crimea in the south, and they've got this strip of land through Mariupol and Melitopol, which kind of joins the two.
Yeah.
I would just sever that to the Black Sea coast, and then those two bits of the Russian occupation can't communicate with each other in terms of they can't pass supplies up and down. Yes. It makes the whole thing much easier. And then you're also in a position where you can threaten Crimea much better. And the Donbass would be the last bit that I'd deal with if I were the Ukrainian style. Ultimately, you want to force the Russians to withdraw by causing the collapse of their army. You don't want to fight them to man. That's the way the Russians are fighting. Yeah. The Ukrainians want the Russians to just think, give up and go home, or there's some kind of coup in Moscow and the new regime pulls the army out or something. That's the ultimate psychological effect you want to have.
Yeah. Well, it's worth thinking a bit about that. There's already been, unsurprisingly, rumours of a coup in Moscow or a sort of, you know, the bubbling of something that might lead in that direction.
Yeah.
Neither of us sitting here in the UK are likely to have any sort of inside knowledge on that. But what's your perspective on the kind of pressure that this puts on the leadership in Russia, this evident failure? Because one thing we are seeing is that on the sort of TV propaganda channels in Russia, people are talking about it. They haven't managed to hide this failure.
Yeah. I mean, Putin personally is totally tied to this war. He, in the same way that he benefited from the takeover of Crimea in 24, hugely, right? Remember in 2011 when he was trying to get re-elected and there were all those protests against him and, you know, he's sort of raging, you know, his power was looking a bit shaky then. And then Crimea happened and suddenly he became this hero who was, you know, rejuvenating, recreating the glory of Russia or the Soviet Union or whatever. Yeah. So he's tied to this war. So if the war fails, that's, you know, going to be very hard for him to see that through. I think what's interesting, I think some of those pundits you mentioned, there's a kind of right-wing ultra-nationalist clique who Putin has allied himself with in the prosecution of this war. A lot of those narratives around, I mean, it's ironic actually, you know, the Nazism of the Ukrainian state. Yeah. A lot of these guys basically are Nazis, the ultra-nationalists in Russia. It's a kind of a mirroring effect. Yeah. And I think what's interesting is he'll see a threat from the right of him which is hard to imagine that there's something to the right of Putin. And so it will be those guys. So does Putin move to the right in order to neutralize them and become, you know, even more ultra rabidly nationalistic and all that kind of jazz? Or do they, are those the people who take over from Putin? Because I think there's definitely a few European leaders who are thinking Putin's terrible, but what would be next?
Yeah.
What would be? It's not like Navalny's not going to take over, right? You know, the liberal Russians are not going to be, oh, Putin will go, and those are, nah. It's going to be real nutters.
Yeah. So that's really interesting, because that, I think a lot of people haven't thought about that. That you don't, getting a coup against Putin, as you say, is not the release and the, you know, deliverance to the liberal democracy. After all, the coup against Gorbachev back in 1991 was a hardliners coup.
For sure. And what, in this process of the transfer of power, what happens to nuclear weapons? Like, there's 5,000 of them.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure people have thought about this a lot, you know, in the American government, the British government, all the rest of it. But, I mean, that is a monumental challenge of how to deal with that. And I think that maybe leads us to a little bit of the why some European leaders are a bit like, well, we'll give Ukraine some weapons, but not too many, because you know, we don't want to, this is sort of Macron's, we don't want to humiliate Putin. But the thing is, I think the European leaders are kind of stuck, aren't they, in a double bind, because if you don't defeat Russia in the field, that's a green light to carry on. And, you know, appeasement doesn't work with people like Putin. I mean, we've appeased him, Georgia, Syria, you know, Crimea, Donbass in 2014, all the rest of it. And look where we are now. Deterrence gets more expensive the longer you leave it. We're now deterring him. We need to defeat him in the field, but we're also terrified of what comes after. But I don't know what the, you know, what do you do? Which way do you go? Either way is going to turn out, is an uncertain outcome.
Yeah. And there are no easy choices. And one of the things that, it's very understandable from a Ukrainian perspective, you're hearing people say, which is basically that, you know, Russia as a land empire, as a sort of imperial power, needs to be sort of brought to a close. Now, like I say, I repeat that if I were Ukrainian, I would probably think that. But it's quite hard to think about that without there being some really massive kind of interstate conflict. You know, they wouldn't go quietly.
Yugoslavia didn't go very well, did it?
No.
And then what happens in the east of Russia, right, in Siberia? So that becomes, I don't know, the United Federated States of Siberia or something.
Yeah.
But so then what you're doing is creating a sparsely populated, weak state with loads of resources. You know, Russia is the world's number one natural resource exporter.
Yeah.
Just to the south of that, of course, is China, which is quite, has a dearth of natural resources, but is very populous.
Yes.
So the breaking up of Russia seems to then give the lodestar of the world's resources to China. So, you know,
it's not a great option.
The whole thing's a nightmare.
Yeah. So you end up then actually with what initially seems completely unsatisfactory, but maybe the best or the least bad option, which is the continuation of Vladimir Putin as president.
Yes, but coupled with, you know, the return of Ukrainian sovereignty to them.
Yes. So there needs to be a comprehensive...
How do you marry those two things? Yeah. That's hard to marry those two things.
Yeah.
I mean, threading that needle. And again, when I look around at the leadership we have, you know, in terms of world leaders or whatever, leaders of countries, I don't really see any big giants who are able to thread those needles. They're quite difficult geopolitical problems to solve.
Yeah.
I don't really see any people capable of doing that.
No. And arguably, there are a lot of people who are... I mean, China is probably invested in Western countries continuing to feel unstable, and certainly, you know, China can benefit from Russian energy. And the US, you know, I think it's fair, Biden's done a pretty good job here, but he's got a lot of other fish to fry, not least the sort of domestic political situation, which is pretty complicated.
And then what lessons does China draw from the war in terms of its views on sort of Taiwan and all that? That's a whole other, I mean, that's going to be another podcast episode, but there's a whole bunch of other stuff there. That the Ukraine war has opened up a Pandora's box we are seeing the world order change in front of us, yes. Right? I think whether we like it or not, we are seeing the collapse of Russian power. Like, you've seen Azerbaijan having a go at Armenia, a Russian ally. The Balkans has become less stable because the Serbian allies are suddenly, you know, the enemies of the Serbians are saying, all right, okay, Russia. Now, Russia is no longer the sponsor that it was.
Yeah.
We're seeing Wagner replaced with inexperienced people in Libya, Mali.
Yeah.
So they went in there in Mali, you know, when there was a French vacuum and now there's going to be a Russian vacuum, you know. So they're seeing all this destabilization created by the collapse of Russian power. And that's, you know, the European periphery is so unstable at the moment.
And then that instability on Europe's periphery feeds both directly and indirectly the kind of far right in European politics, because it allows people to present this idea that Europe is surrounded by threatening un-European forces. And we're looking at, you know, Sweden may have just elected a government which has far right elements. And Italy looks very likely to do that.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? The European far right, like, they seem to sort of wax and wane, don't they?
Yeah.
It's interesting. Maybe it's the way the electoral systems are all designed in all these different countries, but we seem to sort of go from, oh no, you know, we're about to, everyone on the far right about to take over. And then like, no, that was just a busted flush. Now liberal democracy's back. And I can't, it's not clear to me how to interpret the electoral results of far right. I mean, what do you think?
Well, I think what you don't see, lots of people say, oh, there's a trend. You know, for a while, everyone was saying populism is the trend and we're headed in this direction. Yeah. And then, you know, Macron gets reelected in Germany, the Greens and the left do really well. Yeah. And it's a mixed picture. But then equally, Italy, you know, briefly had a really competent centrist government and that collapsed. And the headbangers are looking pretty strong. Technical term there. So yeah, it's a tricky one.
But the Tories are probably going to lose. I mean, I know the Tories are not far right, but they certainly drifted to the right.
Yeah, there are elements that probably are within.
Well, but they have though. The whole party's been dragged to the right, right? You know, they kicked out the kind of centrist Tories and all the rest of it, and they've done that. They would argue to soak up the far right, right? There's no far right party with any electoral success in the UK. I mean, that's our argument anyway.
Yeah.
The Tories are likely to lose the next election in the UK, right? Yeah. So then, you know, will everyone be writing the obituaries of the far right when that, you know, this is what I mean about it. It's really hard to kind of draw a line through what's happening in Europe.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Going back to Ukraine, I suppose a final question about sustaining their advance. There's, as you observed, you know, some countries are still showing a bit of reluctance to keep supplying them with weapons. But it seems to me there's also a practical question as whether or not Western countries have enough of these weapons to supply, because these are not the sort of the simple artillery of which there are thousands of guns sitting around. You know, these are kind of advanced rocket systems, and of course Ukrainians are looking for tanks and other sort of mobile armor. So what do you think is the picture there? Are we going to run out of stuff to give them?
It's quite interesting, actually. So the kit initially came from stocks.
Yeah.
So I can speak to the UK, you know, which I know about. A lot of that stuff just came straight out of stocks. So denuding the military capability of those particular things, right? And then what happens is defense then reorders it from industry, but then there's a lag time to get that into. So definitely, definitely that's happening. I mean, obviously something like the US has obviously got huge reserves of kit, but a lot of European armies just kind of only have enough for a very short war, and then they hope to, you know, key up industry to provide, you know, the back. But yeah, I think that's definitely a problem. And I think the other thing is, you know, if you're Poland, and, you know, the Baltic states and Poland have been the, you know, they've given the most generously alongside the US and to a slightly lesser degree the UK, but the UK is definitely in that sort of top tier.
Yeah.
Those countries are actually balancing, well, we need to give Ukraine stuff, but actually we're on Russia's border, so we need to keep some of that ourselves.
Yeah.
So yeah, I definitely think that's a factor.
Mike, it's been great catching up. Just my final question for you, what should we be looking out for in the next few days, sort of on the in Ukraine's operations, to have a feel for sort of how it's going? What would be a good or a bad sign?
Well, I think a bad point of view is that they don't consolidate that territory.
Yeah.
And the Russians managed to take a strike, but I think that's pretty unlikely. The best case scenario is that they've got a strategic reserve and they put another thrust in another direction, in another bit of the country. So leave those fronts in the top. They've done a lot of damage up there. That's very embarrassing for the Russians. Severodonetsk and Donbass is kind of not so strategically important. Yeah, I you know, try and chop up the Kherson salient into two, or try and get down to the Black Sea coast. That will be, if they can cut that Black Sea bit and they can get down to the Black Sea coast, that is potentially war ending.
Yeah. Well, on that point, let's end this discussion. Mike Martin, thanks very much for talking to me today.
Cheers, Arthur.
We hope you find these war bulletins valuable amongst the huge amount of information out there. So don't forget to subscribe and help spread the word by rating us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any other app that has ratings. And if you really like the show, you can support us on the crowdfunding app Patreon. You'll get the shows early, ad-free, and help shape future episodes, all from as little as £3 per month. Just search Patreon Doomsday Watch or follow the link in the show notes. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
It's a busy world out there. Once you've woken up and got on top of all your WhatsApps, your texts, your emails and your DMs, then you've got another pile of stuff to get through. The news. Honestly, who's got the time? That's where Papercuts, the brand new podcast, comes in. Papercuts is your fast, funny tour of all the best bits of the papers, from the biggest scoops to the weirdest headlines to the definitely not made up showbiz gossip. And it's out every weekday with me, Miranda Sawyer, and a host of guests, including tip-top comedian Marcus Brigstock. Marcus, what's your favourite thing about Papercuts?
It's the puns. It's obviously the puns. I mean, when we go through the papers and you see what creative beauties the people who work, particularly in the tabloids, have come up with. Often I think it's pun first, then story for them. They're like, I've got one. Find a story to match this. But it's a really fun part of the podcast to see what they've come up with every day.
Especially the Daily Star.
Oh, the Star. Proud to love animals.
So if you want to be on top of the news and have a laugh while you're doing it, get Papercuts every day on your favourite podcast app. We're out around lunchtime, Monday to Friday. Perfect for a bit of me time in the middle of a busy day. That's Papercuts. We read the papers so you don't have to. Thank you.